I'm very happy to be here and present this work. I did at the University of York with my collaborators, Chris Fuster and Peter Brown. So I'm going to talk about the strong quantum energy inequality and its connection with the singularity theorem, in particular with the Hawking singularity theorem. This is an outline of the talk. In the introduction, I'm going to talk about the classical singularity theorems and what is an energy condition, what is a quantum inequality. Then I will present the classical strong energy condition, the quantization, and some of the details and the problems we face in the quantization. The main part of our work is the strong quantum energy inequality derivation. And finally, I'm going to make the connection of this strong quantum energy inequality with the Hawking singularity theorem and also discuss some future directions. So the overarching question of all this work is, are there singularities in our universe? I'm not going to answer that question, but I'm going to give you some history of efforts to answer this question, and what little progress we've made. So before I started answering this question, there's another one, which is, what is a singularity? This is a kind of not very easy question to answer. Sort of the layman definitions are where the density is going to infinity are not very well defined in general relativity. But even the definition we give in introductory general relativity classes, for example, a place where the curvature diverges or where the scalar curvature, so combinations of the Ricci and the Riemann tensor, diverge, are kind of problematic. And the problem is this word, the place. Because when we have a singularity in general relativity, we cannot define the metric. And when we cannot define the metric, we cannot say that there's a place. So there's this difficulty with this definition. And if we have a very symmetric spacetime, for example, Schwarzschild, then we can represent the singularity as sort of the boundary of the spacetime. So this is what you probably have seen in conformer diagrams of Schwarzschild, where you see the singularity at the edge sort of as a boundary. This works fine in Schwarzschild, but it doesn't work in general. It doesn't work in cases that are not that symmetric. So it's hard to represent the singularity as place. The second difficulty comes from the curvature divergence, which doesn't cover all the singularity cases. So for example, think the case that we have a Minkowski spacetime, and we cut off a part of it, sort of this way, we cut an angular part, and then we connect these two parts, and we sort of have a cone. And then kind of the tip of the cone is a singularity there. But then it's still Minkowski, the rest is still Minkowski, so we can't say anything about the curvature. The curvature, the Riemann tensor, the Ricci tensor is zero everywhere in Minkowski. And so this is a singularity that we cannot define that way. So is there a better definition? And there is a better definition, which is the most accepted, that a singularity is a place where the geodesics end. So a singular spacetime is a spacetime that has at least one geodesic that is incomplete, that it ends at some point. And then this is a place that we have the singularity. This is not entirely satisfying because it doesn't tell us any physical things about the singularity, like the curvature one, but it actually covers a lot more cases and it's much better defined in GR. So this is the definition we're going to use and the definition that the singularity theorems use. All right, so let's move to the second question, which is, are there singularities in our universe, and how can we tell? So the initial efforts for that were very case dependent. So like the Schwarzschild case, we look at that particular space-time to see if there are singularities there. Or we look at a particular stress-energy tensor and see if that stress-energy tensor gives us singularities. So this was very case-dependent. The first efforts to do something more general were by Hawking and Penrose in the late 60s with their classical and famous singularity theorems. So they were much better than the previous efforts because the singularity theorems just say that if the space-time satisfies 1, 2, 3 conditions that are pretty general, then this space-time is singular. So it has at least one incomplete geodesic. The problem with the theorems is that they don't give any information about the nature of singularities. The other problem is whether these hypotheses are actually realistic for our universe. So does our universe actually satisfy this hypothesis? So this is what we're going to see next. Instead of giving the particular singularity theorems developed by Hawking and Penrose, there were three, one by Hawking, one by Penrose, and one, the two of them together. I'm going to give the general structure of singularity theorems that all three of them and some later ones follow. So a singularity theorem needs to have three conditions. The causality condition, the initial or boundary condition, and the energy or curvature condition. So let's look first at the causality condition. So the causality condition talks about the causal structure of our space-time. And the most reasonable of these, the one that most of them has, is that there's a Cauchy surface, which is defined as a space-like hypersurface where all null and time-like geodesic intersect only once. The original singularity theorems actually had, on top of that, no closed time-like curves, no time machines in our universe. This is actually not a necessary condition, so in more recent singularity theorems, it doesn't exist. The initial or boundary condition tells us what our geodesics kind of do in the beginning. The original Hawking singularity theorem, as an initial or boundary condition, had that the whole universe is expanding. And this is a very strict condition that was replaced later by the condition that there is a trapped surface. When we talk about a trapped surface in general relativity, it's a space-like hypersurface that the two null normals have negative expansion. So to short of imagine that, can you imagine kind of a closed surface and the normals on that surface and that the normals kind of converge? Or you can think about light rays that start from the surface and they kind of converge. So we think that there are trapped surfaces in our universe. In any FRW universe, there are trapped surfaces in the form of spheres. And actually, in the GR representation of black holes, there are trapped surfaces inside the horizon. Sometimes they're called the apparent horizon, if you've heard of that. The third condition is the energy or curvature condition. And in the original theorems, it was the null energy condition, which talks about null geodesics, the Penrose theorem, and the strong energy condition, which is about time-like geodesics, it's in the Hawking singularity theorem. So this is a Ricci scalar, and that is a null vector field, which is tangent to the null geodesic. And the null energy condition requires that this quantity is positive at every part of the geodesic. Same for the strong energy condition. At every point, this quantity has to be positive. So if these three conditions hold, then the space-time is geodesically incomplete. So at least one geodesic ends. So how does that work? How these three conditions give us this result? I'm just going to give a sketch of the proof. The main part of the proof has to do with the famous Ray Chaudhuri equation, which is talking about the behavior of a congruence of geodesics. Theta here is the expansion of whether the geodesic focus or G focus. The sigma here is the shear scalar. And the last part is what we saw before, and it talks about the curvature. So what does that tell us? It tells us whether the geodesic focus or defocus. So if all these three terms are negative, of course the first two are necessarily negative, if the third one is also negative, then if we have initial focusing, we will have continuous focusing at continuously everywhere. The n here is the number of space-time dimensions, and this number is slightly different if we have a null or time-like geodesics. Here we're talking about the null case. So the proof structure. The initial condition, our trapped surface, tell us what the geodesic do in the beginning. They start focusing. The energy conditions in the right-rotary equation tell us that the focusing continues. But the causality condition tells us that there are no focal points. So one of the geodesics at least has to be incomplete, has to end in a singularity. So that's the idea of the singularity theorems.
Can
you
explain why the causality changes focal points?
Sorry? Oh, I think the easier way to think about it is if you think about the no closed time-like curves, actually, that if the geodesic focus, then you will have a closed time-like curve. It's basically about the causal structure of the geodesics. Now the problem is that the point-wise energy conditions are violated. And they're actually very easily violated. So let's see the strong energy condition. And for a very simple case, just classical minimally coupled real scalar field. We have the stress energy tensor. And this is a strong energy density. This is exactly the same as the previous one. It was just expressed in curvature. If we use the Einstein equations, we can get this expression, which is exactly the same. So the strong energy condition tells us that this quantity has to be positive everywhere. And you can immediately see that this is not very reasonable. If we have a very large mass of the field, then that term becomes arbitrarily large, it's negative. Or if the derivatives of the field vanish, it's immediately negative. So that doesn't seem very reasonable, even for a minimally coupled real scalar field. So it was actually pretty obvious from the beginning that this condition of the singularity theorems were not good enough in the sense that they were not realistic enough. So instead of having this very strict energy condition, we can do something better. And something better is instead of requiring that to be positive at every single point, we require that to be positive if we integrate over the whole geodesic. And the first question is that a good assumption for a singularity theorem? And the second one is, can we prove that for a realistic field theory? So the answer to the first question is yes. And there have been actually versions of singularity theorems that have average energy conditions. For example, the average null energy condition, which bounds the energy over a null geodesic, over a total null geodesic. Another way to average is to use quantum inequalities. So the difference is that it's the weighted average over a time period, over a time-like geodesic. And they were actually originally introduced to prevent the violation of the second law of thermodynamics in black holes, which is a pretty interesting idea, because you know the law of thermodynamics for black holes, which connects the entropy. The entropy of a black hole is the surface of its horizon. So if you imagine a lot of negative energy coming into the horizon, then the horizon will shrink. And this shrinking can violate the second law of thermodynamics. So there need to be a bound in that negative energy that falls into the black hole. So that was the original idea for quantum inequalities. An example is the null energy inequality in flat space-time. And you see that unlike the energy conditions, there is a negative bound on the right. Here, tau naught is just a constant. So what we're going to derive is something that looks more like that. So we'll have our quantity, our strong energy density, on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side is going to be a negative bound. As I said, there have been singularity theorems that use this condition are their assumptions. The first ones were by Tepler, Borda, and Roman in the 70s and 80s. But the result we're actually going to focus on is singularity theorems that have a hypothesis that is inspired by quantum energy inequalities. And I say inspired because this hypothesis actually was not connected with an energy inequality before that. And this is the hypothesis. So this R function, we want to connect it with the strong energy density in some state. The R naught could be a reference state. So this would be what we call a difference quantum inequality, so the difference between the energy densities of this state. The F is just a sampling function. So this is the left-hand side. And now what is the form of the bound here? These three lines is what we call the Sobolev norm. And it's just a sum of this sampling function F and its derivatives. And you can have a number of these terms, so the Qs are just constants. So what these tell us is if we're able to bound the strong energy density for this difference quantum inequality and present a bound that only depends on some constant and this sampling function, this well-behaved sampling function and its derivatives, then we can have it as an assumption for a singularity theorem. So when Fuster and Galloway presented this result, there was no strong quantum energy inequality that satisfied that. So that's why we say kind of inspired. They thought that maybe there will be a quantum inequality that has that. So this is where our work comes in. But before I do that, let's see how sort of the idea behind the proof of a singularity theorem with this condition. So again, we use the Ricciardi equation, which is just the form of the Riccati equation, if you've seen solutions for the Riccati equation. So the Ricciardi equation has no solutions. Here, no solution, we mean that theta goes to minus infinity, so we have a focal point. If this hypothesis holds, and the geodesic is complete. But the geodesic cannot have a focal point, because then we have a problem with the causality condition. So the geodesic has to be incomplete. It's actually pretty similar with the original singularity theorems. The only difference is that they use this much milder hypothesis instead of the very strong energy condition hypothesis. So as I said, the problem now is that there is no strong quantum energy inequality to see if it satisfies the hypothesis of the theorem. And here comes our work. So first, before we go into the quantum part, I'm going to discuss the classical strong energy condition, which actually has a lot of similarities with the bounds we'll get for the quantum case. We start with the field equation for a non-minimally coupled scalar field. Where xi here is the coupling constant. We don't have any yet any requirements for the coupling constant. It can be anything. R is the Ricci scalar. The Lagrangian for this field is the following. And then we can get the stress energy tensor by varying the action of the Lagrangian. And this is the stress energy tensor we get for the non-minimally coupled scalar field. All right, to proceed, it's pretty simple. We get the strong energy density. We're doing this for general space-time dimension n. That's why we have this extra term here. For four dimensions, this is just the 1/2 we had before. And what we do is just plug in this stress energy tensor right here and calculate the strong energy density. And that's what we get. So the first two lines are for a general coupling constant xi, and this is for the minimally coupled case. So it looks a little messy, but let's see what kind of terms we have. So we have the terms that have the derivative of the field. So these are terms that have the derivative of the field that we have to manipulate in some way. Then we have the term with the mass. We have the two terms that include the curvature, the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor. And then we have this term where the psi is the Klein-Gordon operator, so it's exactly this operator here. So for any field that satisfies the field equation, this term will vanish. So these are the kind of terms we have. We can get an alternative expression if we use the field equation, and we can get rid of the mass term. And instead of the mass term, we have the term that brings the box, the derivative on the field. All right, so we have these two expressions. Now let's see how we can get the inequality in this case. We're looking for the average form. As we said, the pointwise form is easily violated. So we're integrating over a time-like geodesic gamma and parameterized by proper time. And then the time-like field U that we had here, we define it as the tangent to our time-like geodesic times a well-behaved sampling function F. So then the previous expression with a little bit of manipulation of the terms becomes like this. So why do we manipulate the terms? We manipulate them so we can make some of these terms to be negative and some of them to be positive, but to be definitely negative or definitely positive. So this term is negative for a particular range of coupling constant, which is actually pretty reasonable. If you put n equals 4 here, that's 1/3. So this is a usual range of the coupling constant. This term is positive for the same range. These terms are also positive. This h here is a positive definite metric. This is negative. And of course, the curvature terms, we actually don't know whether they're positive or negative, because it includes the curvature, and we haven't made any assumptions for the curvature. So how do we get the bound on this? It's actually very simple. We have something negative and something positive. So this is necessarily larger than the negative terms. And this is the inequality we get from that. We have gotten rid of the manifestly positive terms here. So we keep the negative ones and the curvature terms. The other reason for manipulating the terms was to make sure that the negative terms have only the phi and not its derivatives. And the reason is that if we want to have a bound, then we can just say that the field has a maximum value. And if the field has a maximum value, then this is just a number. And this has, this is also just a number, it has a maximum value. So this is just a particular negative number. So we say that the strong energy density integrating over a time like geodesic is larger than a negative number. It's exactly the same form of the quantum inequality I showed you before, just a little more complicated. Now, one problem with this bound is that it includes the mass term. And there's a question whether can we get a bound that doesn't have the mass term by using the field equation. And we can get that, but we can't get that if we integrate over a geodesic. We can get that if we integrate over the over a volume, which can be the whole spacetime. So if instead we integrate over a world volume, which here can include the whole spacetime, then we can get two different bounds. One that has the mass, like the previous one, it's very similar with the previous one, and one that has derivatives of the sampling function. So why we can't do that for when we're integrating over a geodesic? The answer is very simple, we will have boundary terms. Here the boundary terms just vanish. Another advantage of this particular bound is that we can actually retrieve the average strong energy condition by rescaling the sampling function. So let's see how we can do that. First, as I mentioned, we need a maximum amplitude of the field. So we say that in our space-time, our field has some maximum value phi max. Then we rescale the sampling function. So we define an f of lambda in that way. And that definition is so that if we integrate over a d volume, remember we're in n-dimensional spacetime, then the integral of f and the integral of f of lambda is exactly the same, because the powers of lambda cancel from the volume integral. All right, so we're using this rescaled sampling function in our strong energy inequality. Here, we're just plugging in the f of lambda in our previous result, and then change variables for x to lambda x. And that's what we get. So the key part is that we have this extra 1 over lambda square that comes from the derivatives of the sampling function f. So in this particular bound, the function f is always has derivatives. So since we have this extra 1 over lambda square, for large lambda, the bound goes to 0. So by rescaling the sampling function, we can get a version of the average strong energy condition. Of course, this is for flat space times because we have the curvature terms which are 0 if we have a flat space time, the terms that have the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor. So this is the advantage of having the world volume inequality. And we're actually gonna get the two versions too for the quantum case, the world line and the world volume. All these are classical field theory. We didn't have anything quantum yet, so we have to go and do a quantization. So we use the algebraic approach to quantum field theory. So first we introduce an algebra and our manifold. And this algebra is generated by this object phi, which is our field here, and the function f, which is the compactly supported smooth sampling function. So these objects phi are well behaved. They have these following properties: linearity, conjugation, the field equation. They all satisfy the field equation, and the canonical commutation. So the E here is the difference between the advanced and retarded Green's function. We are restricting our states. Our states are only Hadamard states. And what do we mean by Hadamard state? We mean that that state, which has a two-point function, has a particular singularity structure. So it's easy to renormalize because we can just subtract that known singularity structure. Additionally, instead of subtracting these singular terms, we can just subtract two states. They have the same singular structure. So if we just subtract the two states, all the singular parts cancel, and we end up having a smooth object. And this is important because we need something that is smooth before we take the coincident limit of the two-point function, before we take the points x and y into one close to each other. All right, so we have our algebra of our objects phi, we have our states, we have the two-point function. Yes?
You probably said this before, but I guess you're doing free fields, is that right?
I'm doing...
because of this last line, canonical.
So the field here is... We're doing a non-minimally coupled scalar field. Okay. So what we need to quantize our expression that includes the stress energy tensor is actually not the objects phi that are part of this algebra, but they're the smear, what we call the smear local weak polynomials. So what are these? They include the phi, they're smear over the function, the sampling function f, and they have derivatives of those. But they're also time ordered. That's what the columns mean here, that they're time ordered. So the time ordered versions of this object phi are not part of this algebra, the previous one. They're part of an extended algebra, which I'm not going to talk about because it's kind of a talk of itself. But I'm going to talk a little bit about why these objects are well-behaved and how we can deal with some problems we could face in quantization. So first of all, these objects depend on the state psi. And as we know, in Kerr space-time, there's a problem when we're talking about some Hadamard state because we don't have a particular nice reference state, which in Minkowski, that could be the vacuum. We don't have a vacuum when we have a curved space-time. So we need a prescription for these elements that for any Hadamard state psi, because we don't have that particular vacuum state, are well behaved and qualified. So this can be done in various ways, but Holland and Wald have actually presented a very complete recipe to do that. So it's basically a set of axioms that tell us how these objects behave. So it's a pretty long list. It has 10 axioms that say things like they're covariant and they're symmetrical and other properties. We are particularly interested in their version of Leibniz rule and the use of the field equation. Why? Well, what we want to do is we have our classical expression and we want to quantize it. And if we just have the stress energy tensor, we can immediately follow the prescription and do the quantization. But what if we want to do certain manipulations of our expression? Before we use the Leibniz rule, we use the field equation. Can we do that when we have the quantum version? Or will we end up having some unwanted terms? So this is the problem we can face.
Sorry.
Yes?
I didn't understand. You said that this was time ordered, but it looks in that as if all the fields are evaluated at the same point. Are you splitting them apart or something?
Oh, here. Yeah, I'm splitting the points here. I'm doing point splitting of the point function, and then time ordering, and then taking the coincidence limit. One form of the Leibniz rule, which is part of the axioms they have, is this, which looks exactly as our well-known Leibniz rule, but it is to be understood distributionally. So what do I mean with that? A distribution, you can think of a distribution as a delta function, for example, that kind of only makes sense if it is with other sampling functions. The sampling function here is that f, which is tensor in general. In our case, it's a scalar. This is the form that they have for Leibniz rule. Now let's go to the question. Can we use the Leibniz rule and the field equation classically and then quantize that expression? Or will we have a problem? Let's see what Holland and Waltz say. So they say that if you have a normal order expression that it is renormalized by the Hadamard procedure, that's why we have the H here. So the Hadamard procedure is just subtracting the singularities, right? We have singularities and we're just subtracting that part. So if we are just doing this Hadamard procedure, then to have conservation of the stress energy tensor, we need to define the Leibniz rule like that. So this is the renormalized version, and this is an extra term. The Q is just a combination of the metric. Why do we need this term? We need this term so that we have conservation of the stress energy tensor. Otherwise, the stress energy tensor failed to be conserved. That's not surprising, right? Because we're doing a renormalization. A renormalization procedure has a certain freedom. So this freedom of the normalization, we can have extra terms there. So they say that we can do that, and we can have this term, and then stress energy tensor is conserved, and everything is fine. But what about the field equation? Well, the field equation brings another term. And so if we do the renormalization with the Hadamard procedure, and we apply the field equation and Leibniz, we're going to end up with unwanted terms. So is that a problem for us? It's actually not a problem. Because remember, we're not doing the Hadamard normalization, but instead we're just taking the difference of the states. So we're taking some reference state 0 and another state psi, and we're normalizing it that way by subtracting the two states. So then these extra terms actually cancel. And we're good. We can use both the Leibniz rule and the field equation in our quantization. So let's yes.
Why does it look singular for n equals 2?
Because it is.
Does that mean you have a problem?
You have a problem in two dimensions. Yes. This is only for n larger than 3. So this is our recipe. We have the classical expression, which is of that form. The rho hat is some differential operators. This is a tensor product. So then we have the field evaluating two different points. And then we take the coincidence limit, so the whole thing is evaluated at one point. So translating that into quantum world, we have the expectation value. And then here, we have the normal ordering of the two-point function, which in our case is the difference between the two states, the state psi and some reference state. So the difference between the two states is, of course, a smooth object. So we can apply the differential operators and then take the coincidence limit. So that's what we have to do. Look at the classical expression, define our differential operators, take the normal order two-point function, and we have our quantum expression. So this is what we had classically. We have our field and the differential operator. So then we introduce the operators that we're going to use over here. We just look at this expression and then write the operators in this language. Here, the V naught, because we're going to integrate over the time like geodesic gamma, is just the tangent vector of the geodesic, so gamma dot. So these are the terms. These two terms, we write them like that. I do a particular splitting so that the operator has positive coefficients. We're going to see why that's important later. That's the mass term, this term here. And then we have the curvature terms and the term with the Klein-Gordon operator. So I have to keep the Klein-Gordon operator here because that only vanishes when I applied it to the normal order two-point function, the smooth object. Otherwise, it doesn't vanish. The reason I split the operator into three parts is that the first part is actually going to be positive, and the second part is going to be negative, and the third part is the curvature part. So that's the idea of the splitting of the operators. All right. So let's do the quantization. It's exactly the recipe I presented before. Only here we have the three operators, which I just split to be able to see the different kinds of terms. So our quantum strong energy density integrated over the time-like geodesic gamma at state psi is the three terms, the operator applied on the normal order two-point function and taking the coincident limit. And if we do that, apply the operators and all that, and keep only the negative and the curvature terms, we can get the bound. But there is another thing that I want to discuss here for the bound, and it has to do with the first term. So classically, when we had a positive term, we can just say, oh, this term is positive, and we just discard it from the bound. But when we're in the quantum world, we can't just say that. We need to be careful about dealing with this term. So this operator might have positive coefficients, but that doesn't mean that the whole term is positive. So to deal with this term, we're going to do what we call the point splitting trick. So what do we do? This has the coincidence limit here, which we can express with a delta function between the two points, tau and tau prime. We use the definition of the delta function with the exponential. And here, the phi star is what we call a distributional pullback. It's basically a mapping. It's a mapping of the field, the two-point function of the field, the tau and tau prime, to the geodesic at these particular points. So it's just a mapping on the geodesic. So we split the points using the delta function. And then we can express it now by this only positive integral from 0 to infinity. And we have the function, instead of having the function f we had before, we have the function f alpha, which is defined with this exponential. And in the last step, we just split the two states, the state psi and the reference state. So what's the advantage of this technique? It was actually proven that, first of all, this integral converges if the operator has a smooth coefficient. And additionally, if the operator has positive coefficients, then that whole thing is positive. So that whole thing is positive, and we can discard it from the bound. So our bound won't have dependence for these terms for the state psi. Of course, this is also positive, but it has a minus sign, so it's negative, so we have to keep it. So from these terms, we get a bound that has a dependent on the reference state 0, but not on the general state psi. All right, now we can present the bound. And this is the bound, and it has three kinds of terms. So the first term is the term that we dealt with it the way I just showed you. So it only has a dependence on the reference state 0. The second term still has dependence on the state psi. And the third term has dependence on the state psi, and it also depends on the curvature. So these are the three terms of the bound that we get. So this is all for integrating over a geodesic gamma. And exactly like the classical case, instead of integrating over the geodesic, we can integrate over space-time volume. So not going to show you the details, just the result. And again, I like the classical case. We get two bounds. And in one of the two bounds, we have used the field equation. And it's fine to use the field equation, as I explained in the quantization section. So we have the bound one and the bound two. And they're both split into three parts. The non-state dependent part and the two state dependent parts, the third one is dependent on the curvature. So in each of the two bounds, the difference is one depends on the mass and the other depends on the derivatives of the sampling function. And then the other terms just have derivatives of the vector field. And that's the curvature terms. So a way to understand this bound better and also see the advantage of doing the point splitting technique is to go to the Minkowski space. So if we go to the Minkowski space, two important things happen. One is that the curvature terms vanish. We don't have a Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor. And the second is that we finally have a good reference state, which is the vacuum state. So we can use the vacuum state for our zero state. And we can actually exactly calculate these integrals here. So this is the vacuum state in Minkowski. The d mu here is the measure. And additionally, the operator rho 1, it simplifies, and it just has derivatives on t and t prime and x prime. So these derivatives are now applied on the vacuum state. So we can immediately take these derivatives and get a very particular bound for the first part. So if we do that, we get this. So for Minkowski space, we only have these terms. And the first part is this well-behaved integral that has the Fourier transform of the function f. The second part still has state dependence, but is just some constant terms that have this space dependence. So this is what we get for Minkowski for the line. And this is what we get for Minkowski for the volume. Again, we have only two parts for each bound. And these are very similar. And the difference is that in this one, we have the mass. And this one, we have the derivatives of the function f. All right, so these are all the bounds we get for the strong quantum energy inequality for the general case and for the in particular for the Minkowski space. But let's go back to the original question. How well do these bounds fare when we're talking about the hypothesis of the singularity theorem? We want to see how that connects to the Fuster and Galloway hypothesis. So can we use this quantum energy inequality to satisfy this hypothesis and to show some kind of singularity theorem with a weakened hypothesis, a much weaker hypothesis than the original Hawking one? So first, let's look at the Minkowski one. But before we do that, let's look at the left-hand side and see what these are and are not mean now. So the R here is going to be our differential operator rho on the renormalized two-point function of the state psi. And then the R naught is the same thing for the reference state. So this difference is now translated in particular for the quantization process we're using. Okay, so this is true for all the versions of quantum inequalities we got. But what about the bound here? Do our bounds satisfy these conditions that they have, that it's just a sum of the sampling function f and its derivatives with just a positive constant coefficients? As I said, we're going to look first on Minkowski and for the minimally coupled field. So this is what we have. I've just changed the variables here to make the bound a little simpler. So the first part of the bound is good, because we can always put this un as derivatives on f, where f hat is the Fourier transform. And this integral is well behaved. So this is just constant times the sampling function and its derivatives. It's good. What about the second part? Well, the second part has dependence on the state psi. So if we have a particular Hadamard state psi, then that is always going to have some maximum value. And so it's fine. It also satisfies that. If we have some group of Hadamard states psi, a set of Hadamard states psi, then we would need to say that in our manifold, we need to have a particular maximum expectation value for these Hadamard states. This is to prevent the amplitude getting very large at some point in space-time. So if we have that condition that we have some maximum expectation value, then also the second part of the bound satisfies the hypothesis. It's just constant time the sampling function and its derivatives. So both of these terms are of that form. That's very nice. But this is for minimally coupled, for xi equals 0, and for Minkowski. So this is not very realistic. We want to see what happens in curved space. So what about when we have curved space? So what could be the problem? Well, when we have curved space, we don't have this nice vacuum state for the terms that only depend on the reference state. So how can we say how these terms behave? Well, the idea is that we can pick a sampling function that has its only constraint on a small curvature length, let's say some tau naught. So if the sampling function is only defined in that small range, then the terms that include the curvature would actually be close to the Minkowski term. So any curvature that is not divergent will be close to a term that looks like that. And so it would satisfy the bound. a word about divergent curvature. If we have divergent curvature, that sort of indicates singular behavior. It's not exactly the definition of the singularity theorems, but it still indicates a singular behavior. So it makes sense when we are trying to say singularity theorem to talk about a finite curvature. Just a word for that, this is not a proven result, and it's actually a part of future work, but I think that this sort of thinking, which has been used before in quantum inequalities, makes sense that actually can be close to Minkowski space and still satisfy that hypothesis. All right, so what did I present today? The classical singularity theorems of Hawking and Penrose that included these point-wise energy conditions that are easily violated. We used a particular version of a weakened singularity theorem with a weakened energy condition, which was developed by Fuster and Galloway, that has a hypothesis that it's inspired by quantum energy inequalities, but not connected with any particular energy inequality. So the goal of this work was to develop a strong quantum energy inequality for non-minimally coupled fields, and then try to connect it with the hypothesis of that theorem. So did we succeed? Well, partly. The Minkowski bound does satisfy this hypothesis, and it is reasonable to assume that if we have a small curvature, then it will also satisfy that hypothesis because it will be close to Minkowski. But as I said, this remains to be proven. It will be part of future work. So what else remains to be done? As I said, to prove a quantum energy inequality for space-time with a small curvature in the way I described, and so that it satisfies the hypothesis. And then the second part, the second point here is part of a larger goal, which is to see if we can have a singularity theorem that has as a hypothesis a quantum energy inequality with a bound that takes into account the quantum back reaction. So this is kind of a long-term goal, because the effects of back reaction on quantum inequalities are not very well understood. Thank you. Yes.
Sorry if I didn't understand, but it seemed like in your theorem, one of the assumptions, the hypothesis, was that the space-time was globally hyperbolic.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that mean it doesn't have any singularities?
In here?
Yeah, it's just a key thing. I'm sorry about that.
When we have the globally hyperbolic, it doesn't mean that it talks about the causal structure of the space-time, basically. It doesn't talk about whether the geodesic are incomplete or not. So it's kind of the causality condition that we put.
Really? Because I thought maybe I'm just not, maybe I just didn't pay attention to Hawking and Ellis enough. But I thought if there was a singularity, that would mean there was no Cauchy surface, right? Because you have not every line could pass through. Singularities in the future of everybody, right?
Yeah.
That's true. But
you can still have a Cauchy surface and then have a.
There are naked singularities.
Hmm?
At least that's traditional.
Yes. Yes.
If you have naked singularities, then you're in trouble.
The naked singularities are part of the discussion of the original. Yep.
Aren't there calculations in semi-classical quantum gravity where there are bounces and with singularity, the cosmological singularity is eliminated?
That talk about the cosmological singularity and...
Well, both cases, but let's talk about the cosmological singularity. There are calculations in semi-classical quantum gravity where the cosmological singularity is eliminated and there is a bounce, there is a collapse, and then there is expansion.
Yeah, well, you're talking about mostly like quantum gravity results, because all these semi-classical
theory on a classical lambda.
Yes, I know about them. I'm not extremely familiar.
But doesn't that mean that there shouldn't be a quantum singularity thing?
So I think these also have particular assumptions in the way they do semi-classics. So I guess it has to do in the way you do the semi-classical, you apply the semi-classical Einstein equation, which is it's not very well defined. So as I said, I'm not very familiar with these results to know what assumptions they have. But what I'm familiar with is that actually Walden and Flanagel have proved a semi-classical average null energy condition. Which has not been used as an assumption for singularity theory, but in principle, it could be applied as a condition for a singularity theory.
I don't remember the outcome, but Frank Tipler was like started the average energy condition story, tried to prove singularity theory using average energy condition.
And it didn't.
I don't remember.
Oh, okay. As far as I know. The Walden-Flanagel result has not been used to prove a singularity theorem. There are definitely problems in between applying these average null energy condition, but right now I don't see any like thing that tells me that it's impossible.
I think there is an by Herman Borde and. Alex Kozienko did use the average, some form of the average.
Yeah, exactly. I was talking about the taking into account back reaction.
So I didn't understand that. What did you mean by taking into account?
I mean by applying
it. Writing down the semi-classical Einstein equations, taking into account.
Yeah, exactly. But we're not doing that here.
But you're not doing that. if you say that the theorem inequality is for any space time,
well, any space time curvature, but it has not taken into account the field back reaction. We're assuming a constant background. It's a stable background. It's not any. It's not dynamical background.
I don't understand. You just
well, that's what. Not a static in the GR sense. I mean, in the classical sense, we're applying GR for the background. It's not a dynamical background.
It's not dynamical in the sense that you haven't assumed that it satisfies the semi-classical Einstein.
Yeah, exactly.
But you haven't assumed that it didn't satisfy the semi-classical Einstein equation. That's what I don't understand. Suppose it did satisfy that. Why could you not go and... I don't know this Schuster and whatever it was theorem. Is that theorem not... is there some problem with applying that theorem?
Yeah, I have applied the classical Einstein equation. I have not applied the semi-classical version. I guess I didn't explicitly say it, but when I was getting the strong energy density, I applied Einstein's equation. Just the GR one, not the semi-classical one, which implicitly means that I'm assuming the classical GR background space-time.
So no back reaction.
Yeah, no back reaction, exactly.
I still don't understand.
Well, if you...
You're saying that you... What are you assuming for the stress tensor when you...
Yeah.
When you get the theorem?
Yeah, when I'm getting the stress tensor, I'm getting the stress tensor of the field.
Yes.
And I'm using the classical general relativity Einstein equation, not the semi-classical version.
Right, but then what's the point of doing all this inequality? I thought the whole point of doing all these inequalities is you would use the semi-classical one.
No. That's how we do quantum field theory in general. Not using the semi-classical version, but just using the GR background and then putting fields on.
Yes, that's true. But what?
Yeah.
But what is this inequality that you proved?
How does the...
What good is it if it doesn't lead to your desired zero?
it's a step. Well, that's what I'm saying.
I don't understand why it doesn't lead to it. That's what I don't understand.
Because you haven't taken into account how the field dynamically changes the background. I'm still the background. The background is still very, it's still classical.
The ratio of the equation, which is a classical equation.
Yeah.
You call them gravity theta as an operator now. And
you would say only a semi-classical singularity theorem, of course. You wouldn't prove.
Yeah, but it's what is the semi-classical ratio of the equation? What is the
quantum? Well, it's the same equation. I mean, semi-classical means the metric is classical. So the range
of the means the theta operator, you take expectation value.
No.
But if theta would be an operator, theta would be classical, wouldn't it?
Well, the metric becomes an operator. And then you take expectation
value. The metric becomes an F.
Just to me, it becomes an F.
So there's something I completely missing.
Yeah, Raphael, let me try to say it to your puzzlement, because I thought I understood, but now that you say that, I'm very puzzled. So we must be misunderstanding. When you prove energy conditions for the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, and you then apply them to a metric to see if there's a singularity or a theorem really out of singularity, you must somewhere have a relationship between the curvature of the space-time and the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor.
Yeah.
If you're writing RAB minus blah, blah, blah is expectation value of TAB.
That does not exist in my analysis. That would be the semi-class,
so
the full semi-classical.
Why are the energy conditions that expectation value of TAB relevant for whether there are singularities in space-time? Why is the expectation conditions on the expectation value of TAB relevant for the geometry of the solution to Einstein's equations?
Yes.
Well, let me say it in another way. We have our GR space-time, and we put our field on that space-time.
So you have a GR space-time, you have a solution to
Einstein equation, classical.
With what on the right-hand side?
With a classical stress-energy tensor. So what we're doing is this, basically. We're doing this we have taken classically what I had here. Sorry, let me go to the quantization part. So this is classical, and we get it from just a GR obeying space-time. And then we are quantizing the field. But what we're not taking into account is the back reaction of the space-time, so the dynamical relationship between the curvature and the field.
But that would just be a different source on the right-hand side, right? But still a classical one. You didn't make any assumptions about what classical stress tensor you have. So that would presume that would...
We have a classical field theory. We can have fields that are classical. I mean, that's what I did in the first part, right? And then we're quantizing, but we're not using the semi-classical Einstein equation, which tells you the dynamical relationship between the field, which is a quantum field, and the space-time.
So you're not solving RAB minus a half GAB expectation.
Exactly. I'm not doing that. That would require looking into that semi-classical Einstein equation and then trying to get a bound for that. And that that would be what we want, right? I'm not saying that what I did is better, it's actually worse, but it's something actually really hard to take into account, that back reaction of the space-time on the quantum field. and get the bound. And as I said, as far as I know, this has happened only once, and it's kind of a strange energy condition for that has not been used for a singularity theorem. Maybe we should continue after.
Let me ask another question. Mm-hmm. So another thing that I didn't understand, some fundamental. It seemed like you were renormalizing the stress energy by subtracting out stress energy of the reference
state. Yeah.
If that were true, then the stress energy would be, if you were in the reference state, then the stress energy would be zero everywhere. But that's not reasonable. That can't be what you mean.
Well, they're two different states. I mean, in Minkowski, it's very easy to see what I mean. I mean that we have the vacuum state, and then we have some other state.
But in Minkowski, it's true that if you are in the vacuum, then the expectation value of the stress energy is zero everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's consistent.
Yeah.
But in curved space, that doesn't seem like it's possible. There shouldn't be a state.
Well, in
the expectation value of the stress energy vanishes everywhere. Because there can be particle creation and so on because of the time-dependent nature of the geometry.
Well, in a curved space, we just say that the state psi and the reference state are two different states.
But suppose psi happens to equal the reference state.
Then you're saying that that vanishes. But I don't see why that's a problem, exactly.
Because physically, you don't expect that the reference, at least I wouldn't expect physically, that any reasonable state in a dynamical space-time would have its stress energy vanishing everywhere. Unless there's some very special thing like conformal coupling. I don't know, and conformally flat.
But
in a generic space-time.
But generically, these states are different, and then we don't have the psi and the reference state.
Suppose that in any space-time, we could choose psi to be the reference state, right?
But then we're not doing renormalization. This is basically a way of renormalizing the stress energy tensor.
But isn't your psi allowed to be any state of life?
Well, state
or something like this.
Well, any Hadamard state different from the reference state. Otherwise, we just get a zero.
That's what's bothering.
I guess I don't see why this is bothering you exactly.
Well, because you say that this formula is supposed to work for any Hadamard state.
I mean, in that case, exactly. That's what, in that case, it's just an empty statement that doesn't tell us anything. It tells us that this is zero.
I'm not worried about the inequality. I'm worried about the fact that by your prescription, it would seem that when psi is the reference state, it would seem that the renormalized stress energy would vanish.
In the case that the reference state is the same as our state, then this prescription is just an empty statement. It doesn't tell us anything. It just tells us that we're subtracting the expectation value of two states, and that gives zero. That's what we expect, right?
I don't think she's saying that this expectation defines the renormalized
energy tensor.
She's saying that once you renormalize the energy tensor, the renormalization cancels the difference.
That is true, but did you give an independent prescription for what the renormalized?
Yeah. In the quantized, so in the quant.
Depends on the choice of reference.
So in the quantization, there is a very well behaved, a defined quantization, for if you do the renormalization by subtracting the Hadamard series, right? So I can subtract the Hadamard series instead of doing the state difference, right? So there is a very good prescription for doing that. But that would lead to some extra problems, which has to do with the use. The only problem actually here is the use of the field equation. So I wanted to use the field equation. So I can't do that if I normalize with the Hadamard state. So I just use the difference between the two states.
That's what I thought you said. I thought you said if you just take this formula that was there before, that just went away. The one you just showed us.
This one? Yeah.
I thought you told us that you just used this. Then there was still some problem.
Yeah, the problem.
Therefore, it wasn't completely well defined.
Oh no, no. No, it's very well defined. It's not well defined within this. It's not part of this algebra. That's what I said. So. That's why we need this list of this extended algebra and the list of axioms. So if we have this list of axioms that Walden-Hollands developed that specify the properties of this expression, then it's very well defined. The only thing I'm saying here is that we need.
Well defined onto some. Ambiguity,
yeah, exactly, with some ambiguity. Yes, of course. It's well defined with
so
some ambiguity.
It's ambiguous. Let's say it's ambiguous.
Sure, it's ambiguous.
Well,
yes.
Ambiguous in a well defined way,
yes.
You might say. But then you can't use it in a singularity theorem unless you could show that the ambiguity.
Yes, exactly. And
it doesn't affect the result of the.
Exactly. And but it does. It does.
But it does.
It does. So at the end, I said that what we actually want to do is to have an absolute quantum energy inequality. So
yes.
The absolute one is not using this difference of state,
right.
But it's using the Hadamard normalization. There, we would have to take into account this ambiguity.
Right.
And it has to be in the bound in some way. It doesn't go away.
Okay, so then.
Okay.
Maybe that's what you mean by the problem of the back reaction.
The problem of what?
Well, you kept saying you hadn't taken the back reaction into account.
No, I don't mean that.
So this is
no,
completely separate issue.
This is completely separate issue. This has to do with ambiguity of the renormalization of the stress energy tensor, which is always there even in this approach. We're just renormalizing and we have this ambiguity, this term that we can add or not. It's an old renormalization effort. Oh, that's not actually a problem. There have been plenty of absolute quantum energy inequalities. You just need to have a term of this form that has these Qs in the bound. You just need to say you pick your normalization recipe that you like, and you have your ambiguous term. And I mean, what we're trying to do here is what Walden and Hollands did, which is they defined it that way so that the stress energy tensor is conserved. That's what fixes this term. And then we say the stress energy tensor is conserved, so we fix this term, and then I mean we have it in the bound, but.
Oh,
we have it.
Fix that term, then you've eliminated the ambiguity there.
Sort of. We have eliminated it by, yeah. I mean, we have.
What's wrong with that?
It's nothing. It's the standard procedure. Nothing is wrong. It's not. It's just not what we did. It can be done, but it's not what we did.
Yeah, maybe.